Welcome. Jump into the Compassionate Leader Circle podcast, where leading with love isn't just nice, it's genius. I'm Laurel Donnellan.
And I'm Daryl Brown. We'll unpack business strategies infused with empathy and action, driving both profit and purpose. Our world is ever-changing, so discover how the savvy leader wears compassion as their power suit.
Hello, lovely listeners. Welcome to a special series on the Compassionate Leaders Circle podcast. I'm Laurel Donnellan here with my dear friend and co-host, Daryl Brown. Join us as we dive deep into our personal journeys, sharing stories from different stages of our lives. In each episode, we'll interview one another about a chapter, starting with how we grew up and ending with where we are now. We will be discussing our history and the lessons that shaped our lives and approach to leadership. So, Daryl, we've been doing this wonderful experiment for a while.
It has been wonderful.
I've so enjoyed being with you, and I got to complete my story in our last session. And so far, we've heard about your childhood and your basketball career and your years at Fordham and your years in broadcasting with ABC Radio Networks. And when we last spoke, you had wrapped up your career with Disney, who had bought them at the time. And you decided to retire pretty early in your life.
Yeah, it's funny, not so funny, but I was very, very fortunate. Disney was actually the seller, not the buyer. So Disney sold the company to some investment people who knew that it was a good business. The unfortunate part was that they didn't know how to run it. So, and I had been with Disney for 30 years, and I had gotten to a level that they said, if you don't like the new company, let us know, and you can leave. And I could retire with Disney benefits and everything, which was beautiful. I had a year to decide whether or not I wanted to stay with them. It only took me 4 months. And I was 54. My boys were 4 and 6. And Disney stock was riding high. So I cashed in and decided that, with the importance of raising Black boys and being there, I had the opportunity to be there and grow up with them. And I was never going to get that opportunity again. So I left. I said, hey, I'll take this little bit. Well, it wasn't a little bit, it was enough. It wasn't gobs, but it was enough. And I gave it to an investment person and said, treat this like I'll never work again. Take care of my kids' college. And he did. He did, and I did. And I got to, instead of Mr. Executive VP, ABC, I got to walk around Daryl and Andrew's school and be Andrew's dad and Daryl's dad. That's how I was known, Oh, Andrew's dad, walking down the hall. And I loved it. I still had initials, but I was VP of the PTA.
You've done a lot of interesting things. And I've been fortunate enough to be part of the walking through the hallways and watching your sons grow up. And now they're both in college, which is amazing. But let's talk about that transition from, traveling around the country and wearing suits and having a position to being a dad and a PTA guy.
Well, it was difficult because so much of my identity was wrapped up in that corporate image. And so much of my what I've come to understand is my my ego was all wrapped up in that. And I thought that in order for me to be accepted and respected, I needed to have that. And I didn't quite make it, so it was impossible to make the transition between that and then find nourishment in being a dad only. It was really hard for me. Because, you know, I was used to having 300 people around, and people do things for me, and not have to worry about, you know, what's the Zoom address, and have to worry about those things. So yeah, it was hard. It was hard, Laurel. And I tried to start doing. I tried to be a consultant for a little while, but it was, you know, you had to be hungry to be a consultant. You had to put many, many, many hours in on a daily basis to be a consultant. And, you know, I soon found out that I couldn't put those hours in, which were more hours than I was putting in my corporate job, and be a dad. You know, I just couldn't give it all to both.
Yeah. So what was the best, I mean, it's been many years since your boys were that old. And what's been the best part of being a dad during this time? And what's been the hardest part from raising amazing young men from very, very young kids in grammar school to college?
Well, I'll tell you that one of the hardest things is being a Black man of the 60s and relating that experience and using that experience and modeling behavior for my boys, who are, you know, they're kids. They were born in 2001 and 2004. So, you know, there's 40 years, more than 40 years between that time. And, you know, a lot has happened. And as we found out in 2020, a lot hasn't changed. So to model behavior and, you know, I think I've said it before, character is everything. You know, my boys didn't know me as Mr. Executive VP. They only knew me as dad who's home, who takes us to school, who goes to our games, who shows up whenever is needed. That's how they knew me. And you can't buy that. You can't substitute anything for that. So they got to see how I was, right, as a person. And you know what a gift that was, and still is today. My kids, you know, we had a saying, when I went away to college and got with a lot of the Black guys on the team, we had a saying amongst each other: when something would go wrong, you would do something wrong, they would say, you know, that reflects on your parents. And then it got shortened to, you know, that's reflective, right? So with my boys, they go out and they would have sleepovers and spend time with other kids' parents. And what I would always get back is that they knew how to act, you know? And that's so important in life, as you know. They weren't wayward. Now, they might be a little wayward at times when they got into high school, but I think that's part of the deal, right? That's part of the high school deal.
Yeah. The great thing about being an aunt is they're perfect to me and they're kind. So what do you think is different now in the 2020s versus the 1960s for Black men? What's the same and what's different?
I have to be honest. I think there's more opportunity now. You know, there were four or five Black executives when I was a VP at early on at ABC. I think that more doors are open. But I also think that the hurdles are higher. I also think that the pressures that they are under now to achieve and to surpass, it's very difficult, because the higher up you go, the more egos you deal with, and a lot more people who really don't want you there. I think that still exists. You know, I had dinner with a Black CFO of a foundation here in Dallas, and you know, they it's a charitable foundation. They invest people's money. And what he wanted to know was, how do I deal with all of these people that have a lot of money, and the people I work with who are used to having a white person in the CFO, a white man in the CFO role? How do I navigate that? And it was eerily familiar, right? So the opportunities are more plentiful, but I don't think the pressures have changed at all.
Yeah. I also think that when we were growing up and starting our careers, although we had these great opportunities, our world was smaller because we didn't have the internet. You know, we didn't have these connections to the world and to, you know, I do think that there's more pressure on young people now, and they're part of a community that is just wider, bigger, more famous, more pressure, more comparison.
Yeah, I think I also think that when we were growing up, you know, this thing with influencers, it's a major problem, and for young kids, for young women, for young minority, you know, kids. I think it's not. It's you know, they people who are famous nowadays in athletics or in show business, they make a gazillion dollars, and that's what people you know, that's what people want to do. You know, how can I make it big? You know, when we were growing up, it was different. You know, you worked your butt off and hope you got promoted.
Yeah. And a lot of it was luck.
Yes.
A lot of it was who you knew.
Yep.
Absolutely. A lot of it was societal norms. I mean, it was, but I'm glad I didn't grow up with the internet. Like, I had enough, you know, self-doubt and anxiety without comparing myself to everyone else. But, you know, I think the cool thing about this generation is they're so connected to the world, to each other. I mean, they definitely have a lot less bias when it comes to, you know, gender and race. And I mean, I have hope for the future. And I think there is a positive part of this connection, because they do feel like they're part of the world in a different way than we did. And they get connected and exposed to a lot of different things.
I think that's the word right there. They have a high level of exposure to a lot of different cultures, a lot of different people, a lot of different people. Our world was smaller. It was much.
It's like, who was in our neighborhood? Who was, you know, even in New York, it was like, who is in our building, who is like...
and much easier to navigate.
Yeah.
Right. So yeah. And now, you know, these kids have 7, 8 jobs, you know, before they're 40.
Yeah, that's true too. We had a lot of more stability.
Yeah.
So they're in a very interesting world, and it's just going to get more interesting, and we get to learn from them now, which is pretty amazing.
Yes, we do.
So talk to me about the other parts of your life since, you're the busiest retired person I know. So retirement isn't necessarily the right word, but this has been a period of time where you've gotten to choose your projects.
Yeah, you know, I've been on the board of Fordham University for 10 years. And what a gift that is for me. I learned so much there. So to be able to give back and serve for today's kids coming up is very special and very near and dear to my heart. You know, so I've been very, very involved in that. You know, we have just had our incoming class is the most diverse class in our history.
Congratulations.
And I can't tell you, it makes me tear up when I think of that, and all of the work that we did, and it was a we over the last 6 years, and I have to tip my hat to Father McShane for calling us in 2017 and say, listen, we have a problem here, and I need your help because I don't know what I'm doing.
I think we should pause and just give kudos to any leader that admits they don't know what they're doing and asks for help.
Yes.
It's never really celebrated. And I think it's the key to our future is leaders that can do that.
Yeah, it is. And to, you know, that self-searching is always, you know, it's what we do, right? In order to keep moving forward and in order to keep growing. And that goes for the individual, and it also goes for the university and for the president of the university to do that searching of where are our weaknesses, and to actually say, first of all, for a Jesuit to say, I don't know what to do, is like, oh my God. So I a big tip of the hat to Father McShane for that. So for them to have the most diverse class in its history this year was pretty special. You know, so I feel like I've gone full circle there. And I feel that the theme of my life's work has been consistent. You know, it was always about being seen for what I am, not just who, but for what I am. And the value of a Black person has to be recognized. It has to be recognized. And that's been a theme running through my life, all through college, my work life, and now also through my philanthropic life.
So when you look back at your 10 years at Fordham, what other accomplishments are you proud of there? Projects or?
You know, I think the diversity part is the most valuable to the university, most valuable project that I worked on. I've also was key in working with the athletic department and transforming the athletic program into a, you know, they really, you know, they didn't have a lot of leadership. And Father McShane, once again, said, Daryl, I never played sports. I wish I could have, but I didn't. You know, and athletics is really what athletics is to a university. It's a marketing tool. It's a calling card. You know, it's not just about the team. Blitzy is barking in the background.
I can hear.
Okay. So athletics could be a major marketing team. You see, when teams go to the playoffs or teams go to the NCAA, right, the Final Four, you know, it's not just a team thing. It's a university thing. And it turns out to be a great draw for students, new students to come. They want to be a part of that. They want to have that kind of fun, that camaraderie, right? So it's not just it's not just about a winning team. It's about the spirit that it brings to the university.
So those of us who don't follow sports carefully, could you tell us about what happened at Fordham through these efforts?
Yeah, so the most the project I'm most proud of is the change in diversity, and not just diversity, but the inclusion part of diversity, right? Because, you know, it's not just about getting more dark faces on campus, right? What you also have to do is work with other, it's not just about enrollment. So you had to work with other, with student development department in changing the environment that Fordham offered, right? It has to be a welcoming environment. So how do you do that? Well, you can't just have a Martin Luther King Day, you know? There's more to do, more to make people feel like, oh, you do get who I am. And really, Fordham, it was slow. It really was slow, but eventually things started to change. And, you know, students of color started to feel like they had a voice. They had a voice on the radio station. You know, they had a voice on committees. They had a voice in the student activity center, right? That those are the types of things that you really have to do in order to be inclusive, right? So that they can pass on to their friends, yeah, come to Fordham. Yes, it's a Jesuit university, the Jesuit University of New York. Yes, it's predominantly white, but let's change that because they're open to change. You have to be intentional if you want change. And Fordham over the last 7 years has been very intentional in laying out the welcoming mat to students who didn't ordinarily look like the suburban kids who used to go there and still do.
Yeah. And as someone who's heard your story through this last 10 years, I have to say, I really admire your patience. I talk to a lot of people at universities and organizations that have had a lot of false starts with DEIB programs. And I think what I've observed with you and all the changes that have happened at Fordham is you didn't give up. Like, you stuck at it and you tried different things, and you knew that it was going to be needed to be organic, and you were playing a long game.
Well, I think we had to, and I say we because there's a friend of mine I went to school with. We've known each other for 50 years now. His name is Anthony Carter. He was the vice president of diversity for J&J. So I don't have that kind of a background. He's really the one who was able to, here's the process. Here's what you do. Here's who does what. And he was really masterful at it. And the fact that the two of us together, it was pretty powerful. And there was also an older gentleman who was on the board who recruits new trustees. And he was intentional about bringing more people of color to be on the board to make decisions about how things were going to be. Because it's not, again, it's not just about enrollment. You bring these kids in, they want to see people, they want to be taught by people who look like them.
Yeah.
Right? They want to go to the human resources and see people who look like them.
Yeah.
Right? So it's not just about bringing them in and saying, hey, you're at Fordham University.
You right? want to keep them, and you want them to, you know, you want to continue this legacy for a long time.
Yeah. Yeah.
So what advice, after going through this and being patient and seeing changes, what advice do you have for other, it could be a university or a church or a company, if leaders want to really have DEIB that is really sustainable, what advice would you give them?
The first thing I would say is don't do it alone. Surround yourself with very smart people, right? Smart people and people who are professional, who have a professional attitude toward DEIB, right? You have to have because if you don't, and if you haven't done it before, missteps can be very damaging, very damaging. You know, we had a senior vice president of student development who did not want to play the diversity game at all. And, he had his own silo. And he eventually drove the chief diversity officer, which we never had one before. We finally got one in 2019, and he left in 2022 because he wasn't able to do the things he needed to do. He could bring the kids in, but he couldn't enact policy. He couldn't affect what went on in dorms. Or the student union. So yeah, you really need to surround yourself with like-minded people as much as you possibly can, and make sure you're singing from the same hymnal.
Yeah, and I appreciate, it's a very difficult undertaking. So having people that have gone through it is smart. So as you look back on your life since retirement, what other things are you proud of in this chapter of your life?
I'm also on the strategic planning committee for our church. I've worked, surprisingly enough, I go to the First Unitarian Church of Dallas. It is 98% white. It's in the middle of Highland Park, which is the
hoity-toity part of Dallas.
Yeah. They have their own city. They have their own police force. They have their own high school. And trust me, they want it that way. And they only let people move in there who they want to move in there. So anyway, our church is there. It's 98% white. Everybody wants to know, how can we get more diverse? And all of a sudden it's like, oh my gosh, here we are again. But this time I've had some experience, and I've been involved with a successful team who was able to turn it around. I saw what didn't work. I saw what didn't work. So I'm really excited to be on this team and to lead the effort. They want racial justice to be one of the pillars of the church. And one of the things I said was, are you ready for that? Are you willing to go to any length in order to do that? Because you can't just say that and not follow it up with a total dismantling of who you are and how you got here. You have to understand how you got to where you are and the mindset of the 98%, the 98% of your congregants. So it's really not about bringing more Black people in or brown people in. It's really about changing the mindset of the 98% of the congregants who think they know, who think that they want more people of color there. But once again, it's about inclusion. It's about the environment. It's about the hymns we sing. It's about who's on the chancel. So yeah, it's exciting to be at the, you know, the 3 to 5 year plan and to be a part of that. And in 5 years, hey, I'm 71 now. Who knows? Who knows what's going to
happen? You're a young 71, though. I'm excited. I'm excited to, you know, be on that journey with you, too. It'll be, I mean, I love your church. Yes, they're in a very affluent area, but they do amazing work in your community.
Yes, they do. And they've done great work on women's issues. They've done great work on gender issues, transgender issues. And what I've said was, let's follow the same process that you did there. Put as much effort into that as you did for LGBTQ issues, as you did for women's rights issues. We are known for that. And now you're telling me that you want to be known for racial justice. It's going to take that amount of effort, that and the same amount of effort and more. Because you're not, you know, you're going to hit unknown, unforeseen headwinds. And you got to be ready for that. And you can't give up, right? You can't, you just can't give up. So it's exciting this time. And again, it's the theme of who I am. And I love it. And I'm honored that they're asking me to help them do this. And I'm trying to surround myself with people who are a whole lot smarter than me to get this done.
Sounds really exciting. I'm excited for you. So what else are you looking forward to in your next chapter in addition to that change at the church?
Well, you know, I mentioned it before, but this, you know, I want to continue to work on myself and evolve spiritually so that I find out more about what I'm supposed to be doing. So I'm not going to tell you now, right? I don't know now. I am open to whatever is around the corner, right? And I am not going to retire and I'm going to fly fish and play golf. That much I know. But I'm really looking forward to my wife, Jean Ann, retiring, doing a little bit of traveling, spending a little more time with my daughter and granddaughter up in New York, and continuing my work with the university. I'll be rolling off the board in a couple of years, but somehow I think I'm going to continue to be involved in ways that feed my soul and theirs too.
Well, Daryl Brown, it's been an honor traveling your life with you, and I'm excited to be part of your future.
Well, I'm looking forward to doing more podcasts.
Yeah, good.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to telling, to asking other people who I've come in contact with some really interesting people, and I'm looking forward to doing some more podcasts with them. And I love this experiment because it's teaching me things that I just didn't realize before, and asking questions that are evocative, right? And thought provoking, right? And not just your usual, you know, how did you, you know, did you think of that song, or did the music come first, or did the lyrics come first? And so, yeah, I'm looking forward to New Horizons, Laurel. And I can't tell you how much I've appreciated doing this with you. And the comfort level has always been so high. And you're great.
And you're great. And I love being interviewed by you. And I feel wonderful that my nieces and nephews have my story available to them, whether I'm walking the planet or in some other realm. And we have this documented for your daughter and sons and granddaughter. And I'm excited that you want to do more podcasts, because I think we have a lot of people on this world that need to be, you know, we don't get to hear everyone's story, and there's so many good things happening in the world that we have an opportunity to shine a bright light on other people that are doing good work and being great leaders.
Yeah. Well, you do that well.
And you do too. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And that's a heart-wrapped episode of the Compassionate Leader Circle podcast. May your compass always point to kindness.
As you navigate the world, let compassion be your North Star. Join us next time as we continue to redefine success one heart-led decision at a time.
Lead wisely, lead with heart. You can learn more about us at CompassionateLeadersCircle.com.